BitCo is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thanks for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan MacLeod. Now, I'm on Skype for the second time today to Cape Town. This time to talk to economist and libertarian Russell Lamberti, who is head of ETM Macro Advisors. Now, the reason I'm chatting to Russell today, an economist on a technology podcast, is a very interesting presentation that he gave at the Free Market Foundation last week. I fired it up on YouTube on my TV on Sunday night. Instead of watching the Sunday night movie like most people do, I ended up watching Russell's fascinating presentation on the state of South Africa's economy. And it was pretty eye-opening stuff about where South Africa is relative to places like Zimbabwe and Venezuela. The good news is we're nowhere near those countries yet, but we may have also performed relatively badly relative to the rest of the world since the global financial crisis. I highly recommend going and watching Russell's presentation on YouTube. It's on the Free Market Foundation channel there. But Russell also spoke about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and how they have the potential to upend or at least compete with fiat currencies. And it's on that within the broader economic context that I'd like to focus today. So Russell, thank you for joining us from Cape Town.
Duncan, thank you. It's great to be here with you guys.
Before we get to the economy and central banks and cryptocurrencies, perhaps we should spend a bit of time getting a libertarian's perspective on the ICT sector in South Africa. I remember the last time we had coffee, I think it was in Four Ways in Johannesburg. You took a strong issue with some remarks I made in a column at the time, suggesting, I think, that one of the options to make South Africa's pay TV market more competitive would be to force it or to force MultiChoice to unbundle its SuperSport operation. The idea being that it would then be free to sell sports to all broadcasters, allowing them to compete more effectively with MultiChoice. I remember you thought at the time that it was a terrible idea. For the benefit of listeners to this podcast, why did you think my suggestion was such a bad one?
You're asking me to recall an old conversation there, Duncan. But no, I think to revisit the issue, I think that competition is a pretty poorly understood area of policy making and of economics. And it's there's very few concrete good examples of where the government has come in, intervened and dictated, either antitrust kind of behavior or broken up large companies into smaller bits or forced some kind of breakup, and it's had a good kind of long-term good legacy outcome. We already in South Africa, this is how state intervention begets more state intervention, right? Is that we have such a legacy of cartel and monopoly and oligopoly-like creation by the government. So, so the mobile phone market has a legacy, essentially an oligopolistic legacy, from the late 80s, I guess, into the more like the early 90s. We've got a whole range of industries in South Africa that were big apartheid state-controlled conglomerates. To the extent that they've been privatized, they remain very dominant players in the industries that they play in. But over time, that dominance will erode. And I think a really good example that crystallizes this is something like Telkom, right? So So Telkom was this big state enterprise, and you know, it's slowly partially been privatized, and for a while maintained this tremendous dominance. But technology moves on, right? And if these companies aren't able to move with it, and typically a big monopoly typically gets lazy, very often gets complacent, and suddenly you get things that are able to outcompete that from different realms, from the left field. You know, I think a really good example is MultiChoice as well, right? So it kind of has these, you know, legacy benefits that have helped it have a very dominant market position. But I think you know, the way that the market is evolving, the way that we're slowly opening up to foreign mediums and content, and obviously, you know, streaming content and very, you know, the Netflixes and you know, various kind of competitors like that, you're seeing an increasing difficulty for someone like MultiChoice. So, you know, yes, I'm sure some people would like it if you forced them to unbundle the sports package, right? You know, firstly, you run into the problem that you're now using government policy to dictate terms and matters for a very, you know, for a private company. Mm. There's no right, you know, to sport, right? There's no right to watch, you know, rugby for cheap on TV. They've managed to position themselves in a very strong place, and you know, good for them. And if you want to watch rugby for cheap, well, maybe you need to go down to the nearest pub who's, you know, share the cost with 100 other people. And so there's actually various different options that you have in the market to consume sport, right? So even though DStv have this very strong hold on and a, you know, tremendous product, by the way, and that's the other thing. So, you know, how do they maintain such a strong hold on those sports packages? They do produce a tremendously good, you know, by and large, a tremendously good product. So, you know, and the resources of that entire business are able to go into you know, producing such a great product. So it just seems to me that once you start going down these sorts of roads, you fundamentally interfere with the market process of people every day constantly trying to figure out and find better products for cheaper. You set a precedent that it's okay fundamentally for the government to interfere in, you know, the dealings of a private enterprise. Offering a product that is by no means a necessity, and thereby you start to trample on the rule of law, you know, quite fundamentally. You know, so we, you know, where do we ring fence these sorts of interventions? And it can start to get very murky as we move through. And essentially, I think we have a situation in South Africa now, unfortunately, where the political zeitgeist has in fact morphed into a direction and into a space where it is seen to be, you know, basically okay, and this is actually also a problem in many developed countries overseas, where it's basically okay for government to dictate how private enterprise, you know, should be structured and how it should operate. And I just think that is incredibly dangerous and counterproductive.
Why is that happening?
I think it's happening as part of, I mean, that's a big question, right? So I think it's happening as part of what's been quite a long-term, multi-decade sort of evolution of what we might call, you know, the genesis of this is something we might call progressivism, which emerged in the early 1900s in the US and Europe. And it was really, progressivism was really a response to liberalism, to classic liberalism that many people felt wasn't good enough, you know, individual freedom, the rule of law, equality before the law, you know, was considered not quite enough to get everyone, to get everyone's living standards up, to, you know, the progressives wanted to accelerate the development program, so to speak, and they felt that 19th century liberalism was failing. I think if you look back, you can see that 19th century liberalism in so many ways was a tremendous blessing to not only the West, but to the rest of the world. And ushered in, was part and parcel of ushering a tremendous era of peace and prosperity. Nonetheless, fast forward to today, we have, this progressive ideology has never really gone away, despite the fall of the Berlin Wall, and despite all these kind of ostensible defeats for collectivism and for ultimately communism and Marxism. That underlying progressive ideology has been hasn't disappeared and has arguably gotten more pervasive. And so we have in South Africa and in many other countries a creeping problem of what I call technocratic socialism. You might call it bureaucratic socialism. You might just call it, statism, ultimately, and kind of state intervention. And it's underpinned by what I called in that Free Market Foundation presentation, Marxism 2.0. And we don't have to get into huge philosophy on it, but essentially, the long and short of it is that intellectual, ideological Marxists have done a very, very clever job of morphing their ideology and refining their ideology and their method and their approach as reality has undermined earlier versions of Marxism. And so they're playing this very, very shrewd and clever game. And so I think we have a form of Marxism now that's penetrated deep into the universities, deep into government and state structures. And certainly we know that the ANC itself is, very strongly underpinned by Marxist thinking and Marxist ideology. One only has to read parts of the 220 pages of Marxist kind of theorizing and ideology that came out of their recent one-week conference to know that this is a party that thinks that government is the epicenter, should be the epicenter of development, of resource allocation, of all the levers of what makes an economy tick. And so I think the fairly simple logical extension from that is that they feel absolutely within their rights as a state to dictate terms to business. And they think that left to their own devices, businesses, somehow have a nefarious agenda and don't have everyone's interest at heart, and that they need this big brother to kind of sit, over them and dictate these terms. The historical record of this kind of state intervention is absolutely clear. It's unambiguous. There's just no room for doubt that when governments get involved in these sorts of economic decisions, long-term consequences are very, very negative. The proof's in the pudding in South Africa, right? We've now had 10 years of President Zuma having placed very influential intellectual Marxists in very key economic positions. And we're just, dramatically underperforming our peers around the world.
I think we've seen an example of that as a microcosm in the ICT sector, where there have been numerous attempts over the years to create state-led companies to try and bring down the cost of communications in South Africa. We've seen examples such as Sentech, for example, being given a license to offer wireless broadband service in competition with Telkom back in the early 2000s. We saw the creation by Alec Irwin, the former public enterprises minister of Broadband Infraco, a state-led company or state-owned company, to compete with another partially state-owned company, Telkom. That, for all intents and purposes, has failed. But there seems to be popular support amongst ordinary people for the government to use a big stick against big companies. I mean, we saw it with the data must fall movement. There's certainly a view that these big mobile operators are evil. They're charging too much. They've got to make too much money, and therefore it's justified for the regulator or the government to come in with a big stick and beat them because they're ripping us off.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that is part of an intellectual deficiency around how economics works that unfortunately most people have, and people across the world, by the way, this is not a not a unique South African problem. I mean, many, many people have been raised in a schooling system, in a university system, and in a broad media system to a large degree that basically, you know, espouses this sort of thinking that some you know, that a group of intellectual kind of elites who have more foresight than you or me, Duncan, and any of your listeners, you know, these are very special people. They sit in these central planning roles. They've got more foresight than any of us, and they've made the decision, and they've looked at all the facts, and they can see that if they create another state-owned company that can compete here and there and be structured in such and such a way that it can create, you know, the benefits that they seek. And you know, Friedrich Hayek, you know, brilliantly wrote about this in numerous ways and in numerous books. He wrote partly about this in The Road to Serfdom. His famous Nobel Prize acceptance speech was pretty much about this idea of a pretense of knowledge that this highly complex world that we live in can actually be fathomed out by a centralized group of you know, elites who think that they're cleverer than everyone else. And of course the opposite to that, the Hayekian distributed emergent order, is this idea that these sorts of decisions are so complex that they need to be made by a large and distributed and diffused bunch of people called entrepreneurs, called consumers, called buyers and sellers and suppliers. And so these are these two visions, right, that are competing with one another. And I think many people have just been sold the wrong vision, quite frankly, by the elites that benefit from this very status, very centralized vision, you know. And I think you can see the evidence of how badly this has gone when just by some of the examples that you've cited, we've seen all around the world. And basically the essential message here, right, is that you can't create new prosperity, you can't create additional prosperity, you can't solve problems by the stroke of a pen or by some whim of a bureaucrat, right? Problems get solved on the ground with real entrepreneurial activity and real entrepreneurial endeavor. And so these guys keep walking around this mountain of the state will be able to solve it by the stroke of a pen. I mean, imagine we could solve our problems by the stroke of a legislative pen. I mean, there'd be absolutely no problems to talk about.
Before we move on and get into the meat of your presentation to the Free Market Foundation, I wanted to ask you just one last question about about the ICT sector. Now, I had a conversation this morning with Charlie Lewis, who's a former trade unionist and lecturer on ICT policy, whose views I suspect are considerably to the left of yours. His view was that to ensure universal broadband access in South Africa, there needs to be government intervention and involvement in the sector, that it can't simply be left to the operators because they won't deliver the services or deliver them fast enough to poor people, to their rural constituency. What's your take on this? Is there any role for government in ensuring service delivery for internet access, which many people regard as a basic human right? Or should it be a case of if you live in a rural area that won't or can't be serviced by commercial players, tough luck?
Well, I mean, very, very big question, and I'll try and answer it succinctly because we could probably spend, you know, 2-3 hours on something like this. But I think that firstly, I mean, the first comment to make, right, is that government has a poor record of delivering so many services, right? So if we leave things up to government, the overwhelming sort of preponderance of evidence suggests that those things become scarce and they become expensive as a result. So the idea that government will make something more abundant and more abundantly available is a very tenuous proposition. I mean, yes, it's possible. It's not out of the realms of possibility that government can pull something like that off. But the question is at what cost? What's the opportunity cost? You know, what are you foregoing to deliver those kinds of services? And Governments, because of what government it is and how it operates, it's not in a position to make those calls economically effectively, right? So entrepreneurs who are responding to price signals, people, customers who are responding to the availability of services. I mean, you know, for example, we assume in South Africa that a certain rural area, or any area, any town, quite frankly, any town or rural area must just always be there and must be inhabited by people. But maybe not, right? Maybe those people need to move. Maybe they need to move to towns that are better serviced, that have, you know, better schools and better infrastructure. You know, just because some people happen to live, you know, on some hilltops in the countryside, doesn't mean that we should necessarily send, you know, all sorts of amenities out to them, particularly at the cost and the marginal cost per person that you're servicing, right? How many, you know, if we try and send out, you know, ICT infrastructure into certain areas, are we foregoing township poverty alleviation in you know, areas that are closer to big cities? What are the trade-offs? So I just think that ultimately this is again a problem of an elite who thinks that they can, you know, fathom out what people want, how much of it they want, when they want it, how they want it. I mean, you might find that you service a rural area with broadband internet and the usage rates are just absolutely very low, you know, because maybe people really want, you know, sanitation, you know, and what's broadband without sanitation? So this is not to say, of course, that you know, poor communities cannot derive tremendous benefit from broadband internet. But it's, you know, another analogous example is schooling, right? I mean, you know, the similar, if you transpose this idea onto schooling, you would say that, you know, rural areas need schools. Schooling is a fundamental right. Education is a fundamental right. I mean, these are all nice things to say, right? But then when you get down to brass tacks and you see how these services are delivered in these areas, you wonder if, you know, things couldn't be done a whole lot better by the private sector. And as I say, you know, maybe we need to stop assuming that people in far-flung areas should continue to stay there. Maybe they should be the ones moving closer to where these services are very well provided. And that's not often spoken about. And one of the reasons it isn't is political. The politicians like people dispersed in all these very, very rural areas because it creates votes in these constituencies. It allows fiefdoms to be created and resources to be channeled out of your big cities into these, you know, very, very poor rural areas. So there's all sorts of – a whole can of worms that this kind of question opens up. But again, if I just look at the broad sort of preponderance of evidence, I would trust over time entrepreneurs to deliver these services for really good low prices eventually to people who need them and who can use them.
Okay. Russell, let's get back to your Free Market Foundation presentation. You basically are very concerned that we're being led up the garden path by politicians steeped in Marxist ideology. How worried should we be as South Africans in your view? How badly are we doing exactly as a country?
Oh, I think that there's huge cause for concern. I mean, we've, as a broad public and certainly as a kind of, you know, bourgeois kind of intellectual public that can engage with these sorts of debates, I think we've been duped in many ways. I think that the ANC was very shrewd in how it negotiated, you know, the power settlements through the mid-90s. And I think what we've come to realize, and I think this, you know, this was manifest to some of the most astute thinkers actually in the 1990s already, but it was very, very unpopular to talk about this sort of stuff back then. It was, you know, it just was not done. It was not the done thing, because everyone was on the euphoric high of the liberation from apartheid, and rightly so. I mean, I think it was, you know, you would have to have been a very, very sort of you would have had to have been a bit of a curmudgeonly kind of analyst back then to spot the some of the problems that were going to unfold 10, 15 years hence. And so very few were able to do that. And let's also say that the first few years after 1994 were kind of effectively sort of laissez-faire, very free market years for the South African economy, because the ANC was basically sort of gathering itself to figure out its strategy of building what they call the National Democratic Revolution, which is a socialist, almost a neo-Leninist, if you like, you know, program. Certainly Marxist in its ideological underpinnings, and they're very, very, they're actually very upfront about the strategy. Right? You know, you just have to read ANC documents to know what the ANC thinks. That said, the ANC is a broad tent, and it does have nuances, within it, and it does have disagreements within it. I would say that there's an intellectual battle within the ANC as much as there is one outside of the ANC. That's the first thing I would say. The other thing I'd say about that is that we've been through a phase where the hardcore intellectual Marxists in the party have been dominant. That may, that may be changing now. And that's why there's an interesting sort of nuance here, right, around President Zuma, because although there's this, big overhang of the risk of state capture and corruption and the links to nefarious kind of business interests and grand thieving that's going on at some of these high levels, or alleged grand thieving at these high levels, there's the potential that the Zuma faction, the Zuma administration, is distancing itself somewhat. There's a wedge being driven between these kind of fairly hardcore Marxists and the Zuma administration. And it's interesting. It's not easy to know which one is worst, right? Are kleptocrats worse than hardcore ideological Marxists who would basically aim to continue growing the size of the state, saddling us under huge state intervention, a huge regulatory web that businesses really struggle to navigate, and that basically just acts like a parasite on the dynamic sectors of the economy, and as a result, we get no growth in this country. I mean, I showed in that Free Market Foundation talk that the results are in on this kind of neo-Marxism, this Marxism 2.0, as I call it, in South Africa. And basically, in the last 10 years, our per capita disposable income, when you denominate it in dollars, is 15% lower than it was 10 years ago. So our global purchasing power is falling. I mean, that is, forget recession. I mean, that's basically a depression, right? I mean, we're basically in a depression. And our emerging market peer group, is their per capita dollar incomes are up about 40% since 2008. So the underperformance is stark. I just wonder if all the sort of key intellectual Marxists like Rob Davies and Ibrahim Patel and B.C. Jonas and Pravin Gordhan and all these guys are kind of losing the presidents a little bit, and the presidents may be potentially looking at all this and going, you guys have actually failed. The economy's not growing. This is glaringly obvious. And so this is kind of very interesting kind of tension now that sits within the ANC, and many people are partial to supporting the Pravin Gordhan faction. I'm less in that camp, right? I think that he's settled us under tremendous debts with very little to show for it. I mean, the national debt increased from half a trillion rand, 500 billion rand in 2008 to 2.3 trillion rand now, about 1.8 trillion rand more debt in South Africa, with very, very little to actually show for it. I think that this is kind of pretty key now as to where we go forward. Have I lost all hope? No, but we must recognize that South Africa is facing, a tough decade, because even if we start turning things around now, even if reforms and really good reforms start happening, which is hard to see, but if that even starts happening now, you know, I think there's quite a long hill to climb here to get out of this valley. Mm. And so, it's certainly not a bed of roses now. And of course, we can talk about this maybe in the next segment, but there is now, you know, it opens up a potentially very low road scenario for South Africa now. We've gotten ourselves into a vulnerable economic position, and a few bad political choices from here, and we're on a very unsound path. If we take that direction.
Well, we're not to ask. I mean, and was a focus in your presentation. How far are we from going the Venezuela model? What mistakes did places like Venezuela and Zimbabwe make? I mean, they've obviously got hyperinflation. We don't have hyperinflation in South Africa. We seem to have a pretty robust and independent central bank. What are those additional bad mistakes? What are those additional mistakes that those countries made that we haven't made here yet?
So, I mean, I would say that if you take a snapshot of a place like Venezuela now, and you sort of say, well, you know, how did they get here? You know, what are the things that are missing in Venezuela that are not missing in South Africa? I mean, you would have to say that there's been a wholesale state capture, basically. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that you had all the best dictators in history, pretty much all of them, or most of them, certainly in the last 100 years, were elected democratically, right? Hitler was elected democratically, Robert Mugabe was elected democratically, and Chavez in Venezuela was elected democratically. So it starts off with a broad and widely accepted zeitgeist, public opinion that state-sanctioned wealth extraction and plunder and wealth redistribution is acceptable, and that's essentially a decision by a society that the rule of law is insufficient, and the rule of man now needs to supersede it and take its place. You know, the discretionary rule of politicians, the discretionary decisions of these elites that know better than any of us how to run and manage our lives. And again, that harks back to how progressivism in the early 1900s started to supersede liberalism, basically with this notion that that the rule of law was insufficient. And you know, it wasn't long after this progressive ideal really gained powerful traction in the early 1900s that we had, you know, the Great Depression, we had World War I, we had World War II, we had all the major atrocities of the 20th century. So once you go down the slippery slope that the rule of law is insufficient, mm-hmm. it's very, very dangerous. And in fact, that's pretty much the core thesis of Hayek's famous book, The Road to Serfdom. He suggested that once you give way a little bit on this rule of law thing, you get you know, essentially sociopaths who kind of jump in and can take advantage of that zeitgeist. And so we have to say in South Africa, where are we in this continuum of rule of law versus rule of man? And the answer is that it's very much up for grabs right now, right? It's very much being contended day in and day out. So you have forces for good and forces for bad, kind of duking this thing out daily. We've had, you know, very dramatic court decisions in the last number of years. We've had dramatic showdowns between the former public protector and the president. And you've got civil society that's demanding and trying to fight tooth and nail for the rule of law, and you've got the presidency in one sense trying to exert the rule of man, and also the in a different way the cabal of intellectual Marxists also trying to assert the rule of man, but trying to do it in a more credible way, so that they recognize, for example, that if you start printing money hand over fist and you create a hyperinflation, you destroy any legitimacy in this movement, in this liberation movement that they're trying to, you know, build on. So anyway, all that to say, Duncan, that I think in South Africa's case, you know, a key thing to watch is going to be the independence of the central bank. That's one area for certain. I mean, governments that have their backs against the wall and that have given themselves over to flouting the rule of law end up at the central bank. They end up capturing the central bank. It's the money pot where you can print as many, you know, notes and coin as you like. You of course can't print prosperity out of thin air. So all that ends up doing is redistributing wealth. If you put new money in the hands of a certain class of people, they're able to bid resources away from people much more easily, and able to acquire wealth to themselves. So central bank, very key. And then there's a few steps for the central bank that we've got to be really cognizant of, right? So national treasury is another key node in that whole, you know, it's a key cog in that machine. So has national treasury been quote unquote captured? Some would say yes. I'm not entirely sure, right? I think as much as Malusi Gigaba gets a bad rap as a finance minister, it's not entirely clear to me that the treasury has been kind of given over and captured. But there's clearly been compromise at the South African Revenue Service. And, you know, the Revenue Service, the Treasury and the Reserve Bank are kind of the trifecta of the sort of capture you want to be really, you know, focused on, you know, as how this is going. So the listeners can make up their minds as to where they think we sit in the rule of law versus rule of man continuum. What my message at the Free Market Foundation was, this fight is on. It's up for grabs, and it's not obvious to me that one, you know, which one is going to win at the moment. And it's kind of all hands on deck for those of us who think that we should live under the rule of law, to kind of fight tooth and nail if we believe in and love the country, to try and make sure that that's the direction we end up heading in.
We've certainly seen the Reserve Bank governor fighting back against early attempts to capture, if you like, the central bank, and there's an ongoing court case about that at the moment. But let's talk about central banks more broadly. What is your broad view? So not the South Africa specific view. What is your broad view of central banks and their place in the economy? And related to that, the concept of fiat money, is it a good idea or not?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, central banks, I think that central banks are a little bit like nuclear weapons, right? I mean, there's not a lot of good they can do. But there certainly is a lot of harm that they can do. I'm on main road here, so you're probably hearing some ambulances in the background. So central banks can do a lot of harm. So that's how I think of them. The central bank itself is the creation of the central bank and the raison d'être for the central bank is that it is primarily a means to protect banks from losses. It's essentially a bailout mechanism for banks. That's the first main reason for a central bank. And secondly, it is a financing mechanism for government. And in a way, it serves as a sort of intermediary and risk mitigator and bailer outer of the relationship between banks and governments. That's basically the role of the central bank. And of course, it gets dressed up in much more sort of formal and official language than that. And central banks seldom like to use, you know, accurate language because they like to obfuscate their very opaque behavior. So, for example, they'll call money printing, you know, fancy names like, you know, QE, quantitative easing, or liquidity provision, or, you know, these sorts of fancy sounding terms. But basically, central banks are there to bail out the banking system. And we don't need them. And in fact, they create a tremendous amount of what we call moral hazard, right? If you know that you're going to get a bailout, you're much more likely to engage in more reckless lending, in you know, much more reckless kind of behavior, and you're much less likely to experience the consequences of bad business decisions. You know, saying to someone the other day, it's not unlike the manufacturing sector having their own central bank, having their own entity that can just bail them out whenever they make bad business decisions. It's very similar. So I think the first thing to say is that you don't need a central bank. Central banks are a relatively recent innovation in the world. They're roughly about 100 years old. In the way that they operate now, yes, you've got older central banks. The Bank of England is a few hundred years old. The Swedish bank is a few hundred years old. But basically, modern central banking is a very recent phenomenon. The central bank has a monopoly on the ability to create currency, and then it gives rights to banks, to the kind of banking cartel or the oligopoly of banks to also create currency when they make loans. And the totality of what central banks can print and what banks can loan into existence we call fiat money. And the term fiat simply refers to the fact that government decrees that it is money, and they protect that decree with legal tender laws. So you have to use that currency in the jurisdiction. You have to pay tax in that currency. And is the only recognized currency that can fully and finally settle the debt within a particular jurisdiction. So it's essentially a currency that is backed by government force. That's basically what wills it into existence. Mm. And then of course once it's in existence and now you're using it and it reasonably holds its value and you kind of trust it. And you have to pay your taxes in it and so on, then it gets its own demand and you sort of get into this state where people, you kind of get over a tipping point and people then use that currency. And fiat currency, though, is very unstable. It's shown in many instances to be an absolute disaster when the government, when the rule of law, the erosion of the rule of law and the incidence of hyperinflation or currency crises, I mean, these are very closely correlated things, right? Because ultimately it's government that controls currency. So really what you're looking at with fiat currency, and we'll sort of allude to the next question possibly or the next segment, which is around crypto.
Yep.
But the essence of fiat is that it's basically a centrally controlled, centrally managed monopoly currency. I mean, fiat money is nationalized money. It's nationalized currency. It's like if you nationalize, the electricity provider, you nationalize the banks. This is the nationalization of money. Mm. And Hayek famously wrote about the denationalization of money, that we need basically free and competing markets for currency, which we'll get into very soon. But the overarching point is that you do not need central banks. We've got tons of examples of successful countries and financial systems that operated without a central bank. Mm. And we've got tons of examples of countries and systems that have operated successfully without a monopoly fiat currency. And so that's really interesting. So if you don't need those things, why do you have them? And you have them because they're key ways in which government controls power and resources. So the state is very integral as to why we have fiat currency, and cryptocurrency and free market alternatives are very subversive to the power of government.
You mentioned examples of places where there have been competing currencies. What are some examples of that, and what happened in those places?
Okay, so look, the sovereigns have always tried to control currencies in a monopolistic way. But we certainly have had many, many examples where currencies have been issued in the past by individual banks. Those currencies were usually underpinned by gold. Mm-hmm. And the gold was often, in South Africa's case, for example. So South Africa is a good example. In the 1800s, in the 19th century, currency in South Africa was we had maybe up to 30 different banks issuing their own competing currencies, backed by gold. But certain banks would maybe cheat on their gold backing, and and print too many notes, and they had gold, and then people would quickly figure that out, and the exchange rate of that bank's banknotes would start to depreciate against more sound banks, and so then people moved to more sound banks. So we had a very pretty free market currency system in the 19th century, and that was prevalent across many, many countries. Was it a pure kind of laissez-faire free market currency system? I would say no. I think that your governments, had a strong hand in that, particularly because they realized that the core of that system that made it able to work was gold. And so governments made sure, more and more that they try to get their hands on gold and control the gold supply. But basically, you had, free and competing currencies. And these systems were very stable. They never suffered hyperinflations. Credit was available. It was allocated efficiently. And these economies grew. I mean, the 19th century, certainly in the West, but not exclusively in the West, was a century of tremendous and enormous economic growth and prosperity under a condition of no inflation, a gold standard, free and competing banknotes issued by banks. So we've got good historical examples, and then very, very few, if any, contemporary examples. But we might point out that a place like Somalia has been stateless for 2.5 decades now or so, thereabouts, maybe almost 3 decades now, has been operating as effectively a kind of free market currency zone. And life goes on, infrastructure gets built, the country slowly progresses. In many ways, so much better than it ever did under a government. And the threat of now there's the potential that they're going to introduce a central bank into Somalia, and I think that would be a step back. Sudan split into two countries a few years ago, and South Sudan got its independence and got a central bank, and have subsequently printed heaps of money and created a disastrous kind of hyperinflationary scenario there. So central banks at the best of times can be a sort of unnecessary thing, mm-hmm. and at the worst of times can be absolutely, absolutely destructive. So as I say, they're a little bit like nuclear weapons. There's not a whole lot of good they can do, but they can certainly do a lot of bad.
So into this mix now, we have cryptocurrencies, to me it looks like the most exciting thing about crypto is that it's anonymous money, that it is potentially unregulatable. How does the introduction of crypto money change the system? Central banks are talking about regulating them. Can they do that? And if the concept of fiat money or monopoly money, if you like, goes away, what does that mean for the future of the nation state?
This is not small talk, Duncan, that's for sure. these are big kind of existential questions.
But this stuff is going to be happening in the next 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, but they're great questions, and they're extremely exciting questions. And I think I think the first thing to say, if we look at modern money as a medium of exchange, as a payment system, as a transfer of value and so on, we've solved so many problems, already in the fiat currency system. So the fiat currency system, for all its negative aspects, has many positive aspects, and they relate, primarily to efficiency, relatively low cost, relatively seamless transaction, kind of banking and facilitation. I mean, modern banking, and I mean, South Africa is actually, a pretty good banking jurisdiction. Our banking technology is great here. We sit in South Africa with some tremendously beneficial banking services, right? So the old problems of money, as monetary technology has advanced, each advance we kind of solve another one or two of money's problems, right? So salt, was a form of money you know, many, many hundreds of years ago, maybe many thousands of years ago now. But there's obvious drawbacks to salt being money, right? One of them being that it's very, very difficult to transport and to actually, you know, transport over long distances, and it's unwieldy, and it's got all sorts of obvious problems. And so you invent metallic money that holds its value a bit better, and it's a bit more solid, and you can carry more value in a smaller amount of metal. And anyway, I'm not going to bore you guys with the whole monetary history, but the point is that you move through these different phases of money. And so in many ways, you know, modern advancements and the fiat currency systems have been very, very beneficial. If you think about global payments right now, they're extremely efficient. I mean, yes, I think they can get more efficient. Yes, they can get faster. But you take a company like Visa or MasterCard, who intermediate transactions, they've given us the ability to swipe and pay instantly, basically, just about anywhere in the world, right? Which is pretty fantastic. I mean, it's hard to beat that. It's hard to go and buy a coffee, you know, in Uzbekistan and swipe your card and it's paid for. I mean, it's hard to beat that kind of efficiency. Now, in some ways, I think cryptocurrency has the potential to make even that space more efficient. You know, don't get me wrong. But the one thing we haven't solved yet in the fiat system is that someone centrally controls it, and ultimately government still centrally controls it, right? So so you have this big intermediary, this big clearinghouse called a bank. If the bank is forced to follow orders from the government, it can block your transactions, it can freeze your assets, it can freeze your funds, it can bar you from you know, making certain payments and certain transactions. Of course, it's also a way for governments to control capital, you know, flows, right, into and out of countries. And because governments are very nationalistic and very sort of xenophobic about and mercantilistic about how money flows between countries. So this is essentially a, you know, so we've solved these efficiency issues in many ways, but we haven't solved this risk of reliance and exposure to the sovereign. And that's what fundamentally, I think, at least one of the big things that cryptocurrency does is it starts to solve for that problem. So you now have a platform where you can keep money scarce. You know, up until crypto, we haven't been able to create digital currencies that maintain their scarcity, right? They've been easily duplicated on, you know, on a digital platform. They've been corrupted in various ways. They've been hacked. They've been attacked. And cryptocurrencies are that, you know, so that's a huge innovation of cryptocurrency, that it's much more secure. Not every single cryptocurrency, of course, but you know, certain protocols are much more secure, and you know, certainly something like Bitcoin in particular is very decentralized. And here's the interesting thing, right? So Bitcoin starts to solve for this exposure to the sovereign and to a central authority that can control what you do and can also themselves get hacked and get compromised, right? So it decentralizes that risk. And now we get to the big debate in Bitcoin in particular around scaling, right? Because I think what we're seeing here is this fundamental trade-off between decentralization and efficiency. If you want maximum efficiency, it seems like you need to decentralize. You need to centralize, and if you want decentralization, you need to live with a degree of inefficiency. And this is kind of where the whole scaling debate clashes, you know, in Bitcoin and other crypto.
Okay.
So I mean, that's, you know, it's a fascinating new monetary innovation, basically. So it's a big deal. And the second part of your question was, how does it impact the nation state? And I think, you know, the earlier answers that I gave sort of usher us into this answer, right? Which is that government monopolizes currency. We have a nationalized currency. The rand is a nationalized currency. The dollar is a nationalized currency that's managed to kind of be global, but it's controlled by, you know, fundamentally by the US. And so governments are able to use that control in very, very powerful ways to control the banking system, to control how not only how they are financed, but how banks operate. And then as a result, they can also track transactions. They can leverage transaction control on people. And that also therefore gives them a much greater ability to tax their population. And if you remove that ability from government, you start to actually take out from underneath the state these very, very powerful legs of funding. You remove the ability to just print money, to create favorable financing conditions. So governments start having to live far more within their means. This is a very, very positive development. You would tend to get, you know, way more chance of getting balanced budgets. You wouldn't get government debt crises arising as much. But you also undermine government's ability to monitor transactions. I mean, this is where cryptography, where your more anonymous cryptocurrencies start to come into their own, much harder to track. And then it starts to undermine your ability to tax and to monitor, you know, transactions and to tax transactions. So things like VAT and various transaction type taxes start to become very difficult to achieve. And so you start to remove some of these funding abilities of the state, and you also fundamentally start to undermine what government has been for so many centuries, which is this central intermediary, the central sort of trusted intermediator between social interactions. And social media basically disintermediates the state in all these things, right? You can now connect with people. You can connect with a taxi driver on your app. You can connect with someone offering you a bed to sleep in on your app. You can connect with, you know, just about any knowledge and information you want in the world in a few seconds. So government used to be these central repositories of information, of intelligence. They used to control, if we go far enough back, it used to be the monasteries that controlled, books and information. And that's slowly been stripped away from all these institutions. Even universities are now no longer held up like they once were as these bastions of kind of knowledge and a repository of knowledge. So this radical decentralization of knowledge and now monetary transaction ability is incredibly subversive. I don't quite know what that means for the future of the nation state itself. It seems to me that it must mean at some level a dramatic reduction in the scope and scale of the state. And that means essentially a big government recession, and we know that these bureaucrats will fight back quite hard to avoid that because they don't want to lose their fiefdoms. And so I think the next wave to be really cognizant of now is how governments intend to try and regulate cryptocurrency. There's lots of different schools of thinking on this. Some say that it is fundamentally, ultimately unregulatable. They may essentially be right, but I think government, there's a lot that government can and will try and do in the interim to frustrate this trend to some degree and could, you know, could do some damage in the process as well. You know, when government's fighting for its life, you're going to see politicians potentially resorting to some dramatic measures. So, you know, it's very much all to play for in the next 10, 20 years. It's going to be quite some spectacle to watch, I think.
Well, it's going to be fascinating. It's got the potential to change the whole world. I mean, change the way human societies are structured, potentially.
I hope so, and I do hope that ultimately it's going to be for the better. I'm in that camp. I mean, I think that removing monetary control from government is just another win for decentralized, pluralized systems where people can be free to make their own decisions closer to the ground where they are. And essentially, it's another leg out from under the central planners, right? Central planning is what has got us into so many messes in the past. And I think it's a win ultimately for human rights, for freedom, because it puts control and decision making ability back in the hands of the little guy. Mm. And that's the point, right? That's the point of, I think, political and social progress, is that you get rid of the power of the gangsters, right? Mm. And those who would centralize so many of these functions. So yeah, I think it has the potential to change the world in very dramatic ways, and that's why every day, every conference you go to, every presentation you watch these days is about crypto, about how this is changing the world, and some people understand it better than others, and we don't quite know where this is all going to end up. So we're all fumbling around in the dark a little bit at the moment, but I think there's an essential grasping of the fact that we're onto something potentially pretty profound here. And I just wonder if, you know, I'd be interested to know what governments are doing in the background to try and potentially subvert cryptocurrency technology. How are governments actually thinking about and responding to it? Because publicly they're very quiet, and that's, you know, they almost, you know, they doth protest too little, almost, you know, it's like governments are so quiet that one wonders if behind the scenes they're actually doing something a lot more vigorous to try to
figure this all out like the rest of us.
I think that too. And I think, you know, what governments do, through history, is they oppose a new technology that is subversive. They oppose it long enough to sort of the political elites then reposition themselves for an inevitable new order that will then emerge. And not all the elites make it through to the other side, right? So some of the elites that don't see it coming properly and are living, you know, in the last century or in the last decade in their minds, may miss these big trends. The smart political elites will kind of, you know, jump ship first and sort of get on the side of the people and sort of try and retain their legitimacy in that way.
Yeah.
But between now and then, you know, there certainly, I think there will be attempts to regulate this. You know, quite interesting. You've got the Reserve Bank and a working group of people in some of the banks looking at cryptocurrency, and there's, you know, the Reserve Bank is looking at that. I'm not convinced that those are going to be successful endeavors, because I feel like it's a step back for crypto if you re-centralize it in a central bank function. And I think it creates, I think actually once you've got centralized control of a cryptocurrency by the government, I actually think cryptocurrency becomes a very dangerous technology because you can now have very, very costless inflation of the money supply. You can also have, you know, if you can control that ledger and that protocol, you can then exert tremendous transaction control over people, right? So I mean, you can code into a protocol what people can and can't spend money on. You can monitor what they are spending money on and what they're not spending money on, and so on. So I'm skeptical of efforts to centralize crypto at a state level, at a central bank level, and I also think it probably opens up those currencies to serious security risk and serious attack. I mean, part of the appeal here of cryptocurrency and certainly Bitcoin is the decentralization of that. It's very, very powerful.
It's the relative anonymity of crypto money that one of the reasons it makes it so compelling. But we have a system of regulation to prevent money laundering and organized crime. Central banks have been working very hard to make money less anonymous. And certainly as we move into electronic payments and that sort of thing and away from cash, money has become less anonymous. The FICA legislation, of course, comes to mind here in South Africa. This almost seems to be the antithesis of crypto. As we move into a crypto world, is there a danger that money laundering, organized crime, that sort of thing could proliferate on the back of it?
The first thing I would say to that question is that it's a great observation, right? And I think it's the essence of why I believe that this is going to be a combative, antagonistic realm for quite a while. Mm. Because, you know, so there's people who are sort of saying, well, you know, crypto is this sort of benign, you know, lack of technology that governments should just get on board with and just regulate, and we can all get on with our lives. But no, I mean, I think if you understand what cryptocurrency fundamentally solves for and what it does and what it certainly can do, it's incredibly subversive and antagonistic to the aims of what governments are trying to achieve, which is transaction control. Central planners want transaction control. They want to see what you're buying, tax what you're buying. They want to, you know, have control over how you spend your money. So that's the first thing I would say, is that I don't think that this is a benign area, right? I think that there's going to, not yet, because you see, if governments start panicking now, right? If they showed their hand that they actually pretty scared of where this is going, that there's a game theoretical problem for them there, right? They need to hold their cards close to their chest. If they give the game away that they're actually really scared of what this is going to do to them, I think you're going to see cryptocurrency prices go through the roof, right? If you know, so government is having to kind of, I think, hold back, but there is going to come a time where this will come to a head. You know, and maybe it's going to be because, you know, too many people try and export their capital through cryptocurrency channels. We had the famous example of Silk Road operating in the dark, you know, in the dark web, using Bitcoin as its medium of exchange. And government, you know, that they absolutely hate that, right? Because A, it was, you know, they were dealing in contraband. B, they couldn't monitor the transactions. C, they weren't even using a currency that anyone recognized at the time. So it was, and so they clamped down very, very heavily on Ross Ulbricht. I mean, he got a brutal sentence for running a drug dealing shop, basically. So it was very, very harsh. And I think they were trying to make a statement there. So that's foreshadowing of, I think, a period of conflict. Mm-hmm. You know, quite how that looks, you know, I don't have my thoughts fully formed on that yet. As far as money laundering and illicit behavior and so on, I mean the essential broad answer to that question is that criminals are going to use what they're going to use as we move through monetary history, right? As monetary technology improves, it's going to improve all of our lives, and it might make life easier for some criminals as well. But it is so vastly outweighed by the benefits to law-abiding people, of whom, you know, of the 7 billion people on the planet, it must be, you know, 6 billion, 900 million and something that are the good guys, right? So for most people, this is a tremendous technology. For those who would use it to do bad things, that's always going to be the case. Whatever, you know, that would be no reason to not advance your monetary technology. As it stands right now, it's quite funny because Bitcoin gets this very bad rap as being this this mechanism through which criminals can launder money and do all sorts of nefarious things. But I would say that, you know, by far, in a way, still even overwhelmingly, it's the dollar that is used. The U.S. dollar is used, for far more criminal enterprises than Bitcoin right now, I would imagine. Still even, and of course, the second thing to say about that is that the broader answer there as well is we need to be thinking about decriminalizing certain activities that are not actually criminal activities, right? Buying marijuana or cocaine or any other drug, quite frankly, in my view, is not actually a crime. These are faux crimes that are essentially just ways in which governments, allow themselves to grow large and to run big police forces and big crime investigation units and fill their prisons up with basically soft criminals who have engaged in basically victimless sort of behavior. So it might actually also be part and parcel of opening up that whole world of contraband, and you know, making legal again some of these things that should be legal, like drug trade, like rhino horn trade and elephant tusk trade and all these sorts of things. So overall, I just think that the you know, we'll use cryptocurrency for illicit and nefarious behavior arguments is just it's pretty facile, pretty weak, and certainly just crumbles in the face of the tremendous benefits I think that crypto can bring us.
Russell, this has been a fascinating discussion. I know I've kept you for a very long time. Thank you so much. Before I go, do you own any crypto money yourself?
you're not allowed to talk about that, Duncan, because this is going to be a very combative realm. So I'll pass on the answer to that question, but simply to say that I like it.
Yeah,
I think it's tremendously exciting. I think that people who don't own cryptocurrencies need to really start thinking about it, start learning about it. Obviously, don't buy something you don't understand. So get in the books, speak to people who know stuff. I for example, don't know much. I think I know enough, as I said, at the Free Market Foundation to know that there's a whole lot I don't know. You know, I think I know what I don't know. There's some people who don't even know what they don't know yet, and they're maybe a little bit dangerous to listen to when it comes to crypto. And I'm certainly miles behind the guys who sort of know what they know and really are on top of things. So I think it's a very exciting technology. And yeah, Duncan, thanks so much for the chat. It's been great. Thanks for the great questions, and helps me as well to, you know, think clearly about things and sort out my own thinking on some of these issues. So I look forward to maybe some more chats like this in the future.
I'd love to have you on the podcast again in the future. I think we could have spent the whole day talking about this stuff. It's really, really interesting. It's world-changing stuff, so very exciting. Russell, if anyone wants to get hold of you, you're on Twitter, right?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, which is at Russ Lamberti. My business is ETM Macro Advisors. I have a newsletter, which is called The Macro Outsider, which you can check out at etmmacro.com/macrooutsider. So you can sign up for that. It's free. I think you'll enjoy it if you're into kind of political economy and thoughts on where I think the world is going and how things are unfolding and developing in this very fluid world at the moment. So I think people enjoy The Macro Outsider. And otherwise, look out for me on Twitter and on the odd podcast, which I'll link to on various social platforms.
Fantastic. So, I'm going to go and sign up for that newsletter immediately. I should have been on it already, I think. And if you haven't yet seen the Free Market Foundation presentation that Russell did last week now on, what did you call it,
I spoke about Venice Zimbabwe, which is a sort of mashup between the two. Maybe you can link to that YouTube presentation on the show notes, and I think people will really benefit from it. It's a nice comprehensive, good macro presentation for people.
It certainly kept me away from the Sunday night movie, so go check it out. It's worth
it. That alone is worth it, right? Whilst we're having a dig at multi-choice.
Yeah. Russell Lamberti is head of ETM Macro and Advisors. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tech Central podcast today.
Thanks, Duncan. Great stuff.